I'm technologically impaired, so much so that I have no slides, but I'm borrowing a slide from Dr. Chauffant's previous presentation because it really is a nice backdrop to what I have to say. I'm just going to talk for a few minutes, and John is going to make sure that we have plenty of time for not only questions, but really discussion about how to get there from here. So it's really been a remarkable year and a half, hasn't it? From the excitement of the Wisconsin occupation to Tahrir Square to the Occupy movement, especially Occupy in the autumn of 2011, all of a sudden the world had been to some extent transformed, and certainly the language was. All of a sudden we had the language of the 99% versus the 1%, the language of enormous inequality and unfairness. On the other hand, this election year has continued to hamstring some of us. We're told that doing anything at all that's critical of the Democrats and the president simply gives aid and comfort to the enemy, so we should shut up about health care justice and work with the Affordable Care Act, which is a step in the right direction, though far from what we all know we really need. We would argue, and when I say we, I mean myself and my colleagues and comrades in Physicians for National Health Program and other aspects of the single payer and health care justice movement, we would argue that no, it isn't a step in the right direction. It was a great victory for the for-profit insurance industry. In the face of possible extinction, they got and helped write legislation that enshrines their central role standing between healthcare clinicians and their patients. I can assure you that as a so-called well-insured patient, I'm a state employee, I'm a professor at the State University of New York, my EOBs, you know those, you all get them, explanation of benefits forms, my EOBs have reached psychotic proportions in the past year. From 2 pages of wasted paper to up to 9 pages per clinical encounter. We need to redouble our efforts for single payer, even as the Affordable Care Act is being rolled out over the next years. So what have we been up to? We've been occupying. A new group was formed called Healthcare for the 99%. And we saw, I speak now about our activities in New York, but this was true nationwide. We saw the enormous power of our doctors in white coats, carrying banners saying healthcare for the 99% or doctors for the 99%. I saw people coming up to some of my MD colleagues and saying, wow, this movement really is huge because the doctors are with us. That really is enormously important. And we also organized among medical students and medical residents. There's a group in one a major hospital in New York City that had buttons made, doctors for the 99%. And even though residents had no time to do anything but be residents, they wore those buttons and they would see each other in the halls of their hospital and go, oh wow, you're in this too. Wink, wink, you know? I mean, it was a wonderful thing. And of course, there's also the power of that medical presence in demonstrations, and also of docs and other healthcare clinicians speaking out about the horrors of the present system. What else have we been doing? For some of us, depending on where we live, we're working towards single payer at the state level in places like Vermont, and we're also doing that in New York, and people in California have been doing that. Some folks are working in rolling out the Affordable Care Act. For example, women's health movement folks fighting for women to get reproductive health care that we need in a climate that seeks to shame and criminalize women who seek routine reproductive health care. Sadly, our movement has continued to be fractured by the idea that those working to implement the Affordable Care Act by creating exchanges and advocating for Medicaid expansion are sellouts, and those of us working to keep the vision of healthcare justice alive through fighting for single payer are unrealistic. Let's face it, folks, single payer is not the ultimate goal. I'm so tired of hearing that. Healthcare justice is the ultimate goal. Our goal is a healthy society where all have lives of dignity and purpose, including access to healthcare that treats us with respect and caring, healthcare that includes alternatives to a drug company-driven model of care, and includes midwives for women in birth, alternative modalities, as well as regular medicine. But here's the thing. The bad guys, it's ideological with them. We know we have the right answer. We know that our answer is economically the one that makes the most sense. In terms of public health, it's the one that makes the most sense. And of course, first and foremost, morally, it's the only one that makes any sense. But it's ideological with the other side. They want to keep all the marbles, all the power and wealth. They don't want to give us anything, never mind single payer. They don't want to give us Medicaid expansion. Governors have rejected it even though they don't have to pay anything for it. And it's not only because they hate Obama and want to see him defeated. As Tony Mizaki, who was a great, great labor leader, used to say, any victory we win, even a modest incremental reform like single payer, opens the window on the social wage. If we can win health care, we can imagine a world with a minimum wage that's a living wage, with decent housing for all, where no American ever goes hungry, where we have good education, free public higher education, paid child care leave, paid sick leave, you get the idea. What we really, really need to learn and to help our friends working on immediate and important goals like ensuring reproductive health care is included in the Affordable Care Act is not to negotiate with ourselves. One single payer, demand immediate socialized medicine, not the public option. That really hamstrung us a couple years ago. We know this in labor. You want a $10 raise? Demand 20, not 5. We need to continue to build the movement for single payer to do work at the local, state, and national levels, in our unions, in our community organizations, in our professional organizations. When was the last time you heard APHA take a strong public stance on single payer, which it is on the books as having endorsed for many years? Anybody? The silence has been deafening for years. Get educated. People lie about single payer all the time. They tell you health policy is complicated and you can't understand it, so leave it to them. Don't. Go to pnhp.org, look up the FAQs, email PNHP if you're not sure about some issue. Get a speaker into your agency for grand rounds in your senior center, your house of worship, your library, your community center. We've got them. Be a speaker yourself. You don't have to be an expert. You already are. If you know that this system is bankrupting and killing us, is denying us choice of provider when we need to see someone, is costing twice as much as anywhere else in the world, and we need a change to a social insurance program, then you know plenty. Don't mourn, organize. Late stage capitalism is in a crisis. John Bellamy Foster says in his latest books that it's an endless crisis. Naomi Klein already told us a couple years ago that we're living in disaster capitalism. It's been a disaster for us, not so much for the billionaires. It's another version of the same old Thatcherite Tina. There is no alternative. In 1969, Barbara Ehrenreich complained to Paul Sweezy about the U.S. healthcare system. She said, you know, it really isn't a system. It just doesn't work as a healthcare system. And Paul Sweezy said, oh no, Barbara, it works perfectly. It works, however, for another purpose. That is, it's a perfect system for creating profit, and any healthcare that anybody gets is just a side effect. So here's how I want to conclude, and I want to go back almost 100 years to Lu Xun, who was a Chinese author who talked in 1918 in a story that he wrote that had an enormous impact in China called A Madman's Diary. He called China a man-eating society. He talked about people eating people in traditional Chinese society. That's what we are right now. And our job, even while fighting for state-based single payer, even while working on Medicaid expansion, even while canvassing for the Democrats, for those of us who do that, even while fighting for our patients to get the care they need, is to remember, never forget, another world is possible. If we don't fight for it, if we don't demand it, who will? If not now, when?
To the barricades.
Wow.
Walter?
Walter? This is for Claudia, actually. I just want to have your thoughts about this. When Taiwan introduced the single payer plan, the utilization, as you noted, went up. And actually, some of the costs went up with that. And eventually, of course, more and more people were incorporated in getting regular care, stabilized, as you noted later on. But if we were to create single payer in America, I could see that, you know, our costs might go up because all these disenfranchised people would now be getting their care finally. And in the first year or so, I could see the right wing going out in droves saying, see, your healthcare costs are not controlled, and it's higher than you said it would be, and now, we don't have, in other words, Taiwan has the patience to live it out and show that it was able to control costs later on after the initial rush came through. And I wonder, how did they manage to avoid what would probably be the type of fight that we would have in this country?
How did they manage to avoid? Well, let me say a couple of things first. I'm not an economist, but I think that this issue of cost, the rising cost, you know, this sort of economist view of the world is really misguided. You know, cost for one is a gain for some other. So it all depends on who's paying for what, right? I mean, the costs on aggregate may be stuff, but then it costs me more money when I get sick. Then, you know, it sort of depends on what's a win for one is a loss for another one. If we were paying, say, just to make a round number, say $4,000 per person per capita, as the rest of the countries are doing, Taiwan pays less than that, and you multiply that by, say, you know, 300 million Americans, it would give you still an expense on aggregate of 50% of what we're spending now, and would leave about $1.2 billion, a small change, to do whatever you want, right? For instance, throw it to the schools. So the first thing that you do with a single-payer system is, of course, you cream out all this administrative waste that folks were talking about. Then, of course, you've got to get a control over pricing, right? It's not about cost. It doesn't cost anybody, you know, $10,000, $20,000, right? It's the price that they put in the market because somebody's going to pay for it, right? So the way they did it is simply they didn't pay attention to that, right? They had a political and social tsunami of people who were uninsured, who were dying, who were going bankrupt, and then they were going to be thrown out of office, which nobody in our system, as far as I know, has ever been threatened with. So now that's the short version. There are more details to it. There was really a strong, you know, commitment, political leadership, and so forth. In other words, but there was huge popular pressure. So cost, you know, nobody got hung up with that kind of talk, right? They just did it. And after they did it, of course, the costs did go up. I mean, costs, again, for who? The aggregate expenditure of the country did go up a bit, right? And then stabilized. But the counterpart of that was that you got all these people into the system without doing any of this delivery stuff and, you know, patient homes and, you know, all these big sounding wonderful words. Who's going to argue about the need for patient home, right? They would like the patient, not the medical home, I'm sorry. But anyway, so but they just did it. They grabbed the finances by the neck and they implemented that, you know, pretty much overnight. And the sky didn't fall on them, right? So that was the thing. They kind of ignored this kind of, you know, debate that goes on when you leave enough time for a sort of a distracting debate. And the satisfaction rate that was very low at the systems implementation, about 38%, it dramatically went up in about a year when they measured it again. They've been measuring it ever since, and ever since, the satisfaction rate with the system goes up and up and up, because who do you ask? You know, well, the patients. And the patients don't have to navigate anything to get their care. They just simply walk in the door, and they get the care they want or they need. So, it's a long answer to your specific question.
I think an interesting example was in Canada. They had an actual experiment going because they didn't do a sweeping national health program all in one bite. It actually progressed province by province. And the last province to actually implement a provincial health program was Quebec. And what they found was, is the number of visits for rich people went down and the number of visits for poor people went up. The supply of physicians didn't change when they went over. What happened was we started acting in a moral and appropriate way, delivering services to those that needed it, rather than delivering services to those with money. So to me, I think this would be a very productive thing for us, in all honesty, especially when prices are controlled and you get the same thing no matter who the patient is, the CEO of IBM or the bum on the street, you get paid the same. We know who needs the care. We know who needs the attention as clinicians. So I think that this is actually a false boogeyman for us in terms of this change. I think that we will appropriately ration ourselves as clinicians to meet the needs of those who have the greatest needs, which will mean that we're finally taking care of the poor and disenfranchised. And so to me, I'm not fearful of this at all.
Other questions, comments? Yeah?
Yeah, in terms of that, back on that transition, I'm always wondering, like, the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies, I mean, they're, insurance companies specifically, they're going to, all their jobs are going to be gone. So it's like, is that knowledge that they've built up and all the billing and all their super technical paperwork moving, how is that going to be, I mean, I can envision them having, you know, retooling and doing this similar sort of work with for the government or whatever, and I'm just wondering if there's any sort of like strategizing and how to like take that rebuttal of some.
Well, we have two wonderful colleagues in the back here who could answer this question better than I can, but I'll try to channel them a little bit. David Himmelstein and Steffi Wollhandlers, who are the leading lights in physicians for National Health Program. This would be my understanding. First of all, HR 676, which is our national bill, and I'm from Ohio, we have an Ohio single-payer bill, and I imagine there's one in Vermont also. They all include money, because there's going to be a lot of money left over here. I mean, we're wasting all this money on BS and not care. We actually have money for the transition, for transitioning people out of useless paper-pushing, people harming jobs, into jobs where they actually can go home and feel good about themselves, you know? We have lots of needs for caregivers. I mean, there's caregiving to be done, especially in nursing home care. There's lots of room for additional caregiving. And these people, you know, you can't work in the insurance industry unless you can read, write, add, and subtract. You know, you're pretty educable, and you're also pretty fungible, transferable from one industry to another. You know, I didn't see a whole lot of crocodile tears shed by the right wing when our steel industry basically evaporated, you know. I'm certainly not going to shed any crocodile tears for this financial services industry that really produces no good for anyone and actually is in the way of 50 million people getting care and allows 50,000 deaths to happen every year from uninsurance alone. I mean, if you actually add up the deaths in the last decade, it exceeds the deaths of our soldiers in Vietnam. This is worse than war. It's every year, 1 year of these deaths is worse than the deaths from the Vietnam War. I mean, we're talking about friends and neighbors dying every year in the tens of thousands. And so, I mean, to me, I'm not going to shed a lot of tears as we transition in that particular industry. There will still be jobs for people who need to participate in the smaller administrative aspects of healthcare. We still probably have to process bills, but That's even becoming less of an issue for the insurance industry with advances in computer technology and whatever. So, and the smart card things we heard about, I mean, we can drive administrative costs down. The Canadians have done it, Taiwanese have done it. Why should we waste 30 cents on the dollar, you know, on bureaucracy with everybody primarily chasing money? You know, in all honesty, the cost, the profits, I mean, they're evil enough, but they're probably in the range of $50 to $100 billion a year out of $2.8
trillion. I mean,
we should pay them to go away. I mean, it'll be cheap. Just give them the money and say, please leave us alone. Okay, you shook us down. We understand that. Here's your money. Go away. Let us have a health care system.
The other thing is the employers are going to save money from the national insurance, and then they're going to be able to hire more people for other jobs.
And pay us more.
Yeah. Wages up, the more people have money to buy things.
Let me just add something to what John was saying. What kind of jobs are going to be lost, right? I mean, the CEO jobs that make millions and millions of dollars or more, those we don't care about, right? What we care is about the little guy, right? The one who's answering the phone when you call to get a premium, to get a quote. So I did this exercise with my students. I did it a couple of years ago. I've done it several times, actually. And I send them out to shop for health insurance as if they didn't have, and many of them don't, right? Many of them don't. And make up a case or, you know, lie a little bit, whatever. You know, I'm looking for health insurance, I'm not going to be graduating or whatnot, and engage in a conversation with the person and try to get some information. So, for instance, engaging in a conversation, asking them, well, how do you get your health insurance? You know that most people who answer the phone, they don't have health insurance. So, and some of them do, and they get those, they take those crappy jobs just to have, you know, a bare bones crappy coverage. So you would get, you know, a much better bang for your buck for ordinary people like us or whatever, if you have this completely out of the way. It's really not a problem, it's a pseudo problem, as John was saying, right? The companies and the industries that, you know, that go bankrupt or that they decide to pull the plug and say, you know what, my money is better worth in, you know, Canada or elsewhere or whatever, right? Because we can't foot the bill of our health insurance costs. Nobody makes an issue out of those. So I do, you know, agree with John's point that it's sort of a distraction again.
Yeah?
Well, I would take a little issue with that. I'm with the Labor Campaign for Single Payer. And I think whenever you advocate for far-reaching social change, you have an absolute responsibility to make sure that the working class people who are affected by that change adversely have got to be taken care of. And if you don't, you're just opening yourself up for all kinds of right-wing populist counter-assaults. And if you don't believe me, take a look at how coal mining is playing out in southern Ohio and West Virginia and western Pennsylvania right now in this election. You've got to be able to formulate this issue with an understanding that that there will be a just transition for those affected workers. There's 2 million people who, at least, who do wasteful work in this healthcare system. Every doctor in America has a full-time employee whose sole responsibility is to argue with an insurance company. Mm-hmm. And every insurance company has a full-time employee who argues with that doctor's employee. And then you have the, you know, hundreds of people in every hospital who bill for every tablet and Band-Aid consumed at outrageous rates. So that's a gigantic complex of people who, you know, are just working people and are trying to get through the year. And, you know, so there has got to be real money put aside in these healthcare bills, and there has to be an organizing approach to this change that says that these are not the folks who will be affected, that there will in fact be, you know, new opportunities created for people. People go out in the communities and deal with diabetes and, you know, all of the kind of real positive work that needs to be done in this healthcare system. I think at our peril, if we dismiss those issues, as we build this movement, we will find that that's going to be used as a real hammer against us.
Anybody else?
Other questions, comments?
I could just to follow up on what you said. We desperately need more people to take care of patients. The primary care infrastructure is really hanging by a thread, and the community hospital, especially in rural areas, infrastructure is hanging by a thread, and is frayed really beyond the point where we can even produce normal population outcomes compared to, you know, other countries. So I agree that we should be demanding that part of our proposal should be worker retraining to redeploy people from useless occupations into actual caregiving. And I think that could easily be done. And those workers would like their work better, I think. And I mean, I know from the people that work in my office and hospital who are doing administrative work and working in the accounting department and so forth, many times they expressed the wish to move over into more patient care functions. And many times they do that, and they, you know, they get a promotion or a lateral transfer, what have you, and they're you know, they enjoy it much better, because that's what the system is really intended to do.
Yeah. Well, Mark was kind of on the comment, but go.
So follow up on Sarah, what you just said, you know, there's all these, I work in a medical, medical school, health sciences school, right, medical school, nursing school, and so forth. There's so many docs and so many recent graduates who are choosing to go into this paper pushing because it just pays so much better than patient care. And that is something that is so, not only the things that we do identify, but the ones that nobody talks about, see all this, you know, energy wasted, and people who have been trained to do patient care and then just move on to the industry. That's another thing to bear in mind.
So it's almost time over here, so I just
gonna let Mark kind of close us here.
So I trust that you're eager to rush out and start fighting for single-payer national health care, and one place to start would be to go to pnhp.org. We have chapters and individuals working every place in the country, and we would welcome you. If you're not a physician, you're just as welcome. I'm not a physician, I'm vice chair of the New York Metro chapter. If you would like to work with other grassroots organizations fighting for the same thing, Mark Dudzik is the executive director of Labor Campaign for Single Payer, as he mentioned. So if you're involved in a union, that'd be a great resource. Healthcare-now.org is an awesome nationwide grassroots organization. In California, specifically in San Francisco, we have the folks who made that bumper sticker, singlepayernow.org. So, excuse me? Is it .net? No, I think it's singlepayernow. Oh, .net, sorry, .. So get involved. We need you. And we just need to keep this site going. Thanks so much for coming.